I guess it's the official start of this morning's science program. And well, as you have read probably on the program, this is going to be about the INF. So it's not really the interior of stars, but it's probably sort of one of the key ingredients and maybe a key ingredient to all our proposals. So if we're discussing the INF, I'm discussing in this context here now the INF of massive stars. And you know, massive stars, as we've been hearing, for example, from Elliot, they're supposed to be these cosmic engines. And what I mean with that is basically you have all the radiative, the kinetic, and the chemical feedback. So the radiative, for example, if you really want to put it to the extreme, that's about the reionization of the universe, the kinetic energy that is from all these massive stellar winds, from the supernovae, and they're driving basically galaxy evolution. And the chemical feedback, I guess I don't really need to explain that, because I mean, just look around, and this is certainly not hydrogen and helium. So this is why we say that's massive stars, and they're extremely important in the universe, and that's how we usually make our point. And then there's a second thing. You say cosmic engines, and then probably cosmic probes. And cosmic probes, that basically relates to all the stellar transients that are happening towards the end of the star's life. So the supernovae, long-duration gamma ray bursts, stellar mergers, mergers of compact objects, and you can basically see them throughout the universe, and so you can even probe the universe. And a key ingredient in all of that, if you want to make this point, that massive stars play an important role, that is the IMF. And so this is why this talk is probably then about the concept of the whole thing. And just to maybe to remind you what the IMF really is. So let me draw this kind of diagram. So I'm trying to plot basically the logarithmic number of stars in some mass interval. So I'm denoting that by dm. All right, and you just plot it against mass itself. Well, in a simple description, for example, take the Cooper INF, you have a three-part power law function. So the power law is sort of shallowest here, then there is sort of a regime where it bends over, and then it's getting steeper towards the high mass end, and maybe just to indicate a couple of masses in here. This is roughly half a solar mass, and if you're talking about this bend here, that is 0.0 solar mass. So all stuff that is not really interesting to us. The interesting bit is basically this one power law that is at the end of it. And you can then write down what this mass function, how it looks like. And as I said, it's a power law, so it's an extremely simple function. It's just going to be proportional to the mass of our star, the initial mass of a star, and then there is some exponent, and it's usually called gamma, or smaller case gamma. And then you can put values here, that is roughly 0.3. In these units, we have 1.3 in this regime, and the stuff that is important for us, here the exponent is roughly 2.3. So if you go and play,
get confused as the really dn, dm, or is it dn log d log m?
So in these units, it is dn dm.
Okay.
If you write it in often, then in something like dn d log m.
And you add an extra power.
Exactly, that's what's going to happen, right? So you basically add another power in here. So it's something like, something like that. Or you can denote it as just with a capital gamma. So if you're at some point seeing the capital gamma and the smaller case gamma, they're just different by one. And just depends on how you define the mass function. So I'll try to stick to this notation. Okay? All right. So this, the beauty of it is so simple. It's just a follow-up. And it's telling us a lot about stars. And in terms of massive stars, of course, we're, for example, interested in the fraction of massive stars. And it's easy to compute that just from power law. So if you want to compute this fraction, you basically integrate this IMF, and maybe let's give it some name, Xi. So you're basically integrating it, and you're integrating it over the mass range of interest to you. So we want to know the number of massive stars. We go from 10 solar masses up to, well, let's put infinity here. We're going to discuss that in a second, or a few moments. And you basically normalize it then to the whole mass function. And that is just a fraction of massive stars, okay? It's a very simple thing. Well, and if you do that, I guess you know this is not much. So if you take out the integration, it comes to basically 0.5%. This is the number or the fraction of massive stars. Still, these objects are doing all this feedback and giving us all this great information. All right. And maybe a couple of other two numbers that are interesting in that respect is, if you want to know how many massive stars do you need per solar mass of material formed, for example, produce one quark-collapse supernova, you can play that game, you can just compute it. And what comes out is that if you want to have one quark-collapse supernova, then what you need it is roughly of the order of 10 to the 2 solar masses. So if you form stars of the order of 100 solar masses, maybe a bit more, then you can expect to get one quark-collapse supernova out of it. If you want to have now one pair instability supernova, well, that number goes up, so you need to form more mass. And the ballpark number is something like 10 to the 4 solar masses. So if you form, in principle, a star cluster of 10 to the 4 solar masses, on average, you may expect that this cluster is, in principle, able to form a pair instability supernova, depending a bit on this thingy up here, okay?
Were you assuming this required for
appearance? Well, I was just assuming, I think, a mass range from something like 140 up to 260, and then integrating that range. Yes. Another interesting feature of the mass function itself is, of course, where is the mass in such a star cluster? And the mass usually is sort of with the lower mass stars, and you can just compute it, basically, from a similar thing as before, but now we're not integrating only the mass function, but we're integrating the mass in stars. So what we're doing is take out the same integral, but put the mass in here, normalize it to the total mass of the, and of course we again want to sort of do it for our massive stars, normalize it to the total mass that we have. Any guesses how that would come out? Well, this is 0.5% in number.
It's still small,
but it's going to be... Well, yeah, I think if I did it correctly, it's roughly 20%, if I cut it at 10 solar masses. So yes, most of the mass is sitting in the low mass regime, but this is already considerable.
Yeah, it's okay. For global clusters, which in our galaxy, it's about 40% mass is lost, which means with all the stars about like one, right? So then we'll give you...
I mean, one of the things is when you did the interval, you have to put a lower end cutoff because right now you've got the
yes.
Not having any lower mass cutoff.
That is true.
There's got to be a lower mass cutoff.
That is true. I put the lower mass cutoff at 0.08 solar masses because I'm not sure whether I want to call anything that is below that a star.
Okay. Well, people who do ground dwarfs will triple argue.
Yes, so they would probably disagree with what I wrote down now. Yeah, yeah.
But I don't quite understand the two other lines, the CCSM per 100 solar masses. So you're saying that if I want to have one core collapse supernova, I have to have a cluster with 100 solar masses. Shouldn't it be 1,000? Because there's only one in, is it one 100 stars, but you have to make them be 10 solar masses or above, so that should be 10 times. In other words, I don't quite understand why it's only 10 to the 2. If you had a cluster of 10 to the 2, you make one solar mass star, that's 10% of your mass has gone into 10 solar mass stars. So you want that to be less than 1%. So shouldn't that really be 10 to the 3?
No, I think it's still 10 to the... It is not exactly 100. So if you do just a computation with a pure Cooper mass function, you come up with something like 170 or something.
So the argument,
that's the ballpark number for...
Yeah, it's 156 for the metallicity 0.01.
To be on my pay grade, I just want to understand where the calculation comes from. To me, if you have half, if you're saying the core class supernova for anything that's above 10 solar masses, and only a half a percent of stars are doing that, the total amount of stars in the cluster has to be doesn't have to be 10 times. You have to have 10. That's like saying you have a cluster with only 100 solar masses, and you made one core collapse supernova, that's 10% of the mass.
I wasn't too sure where the confusion was.
The second line is more relevant, so the 20%, it's more like 10% of the mass goes into the mass of stars.
And an interesting thing that I want you to remember or keep in mind for later on, if I'm going to change the slope in the high mass regime now from 2.3 to 1.9, the mass, or say if I just go below 2.0, the mass, or the most of the mass in the cluster, is going to sit in the high mass end. And this fraction goes up to 50% if I use a high mass gamma here of 1.9. Okay, just keep it in mind for later. And what I also already alluded to is, imagine you have a high mass gamma of less than 2, then most of the mass is going to sit in the high mass regime. So if you compute basically the mass that is in the high mass end, you see it's going also to diverge in this case. So if you write down what the total mass is, and you're just maybe interested now in, again, some high mass regime, or you can put in any numbers that you like, and then this integral is going to diverge. If you use a power law IMF, so at that point, if you're discussing feedback or any other processes, and if you want to use a gamma that is below 2.0, we have to define an upper limit for the mass function.
That's what you did in the line above then.
Yes. I was picking. In fact, this number is not too sensitive to exactly the number of the mass limit.
Yes.
So you can play with 300, 400, 500.
It diverges. It's
different. Yes, it diverges, but if you go to infinity, yeah. Just to keep that in mind, if you do that, you have to also think about the upper mass limit, what it is, and exactly how you define it is going to impact, for example, how many massive stars you're going to have and what the feedback is. Okay. That's the only point I wanted to make here. And now I want to come basically to the big question, how do we measure the mass function? So it's great that it appears to be some power law function, but how do we actually get to it, and how can we obtain it? And it is a bit complicated. I think you all saw the note. I'd like to remove it, okay, barbecue tonight?
That's okay.
And the problem with all of that is the following. The IMF and also the star formation history, they're intrinsically, inherently entangled. Or if you want to say it in different words, they're degenerate. So if you want to figure out what the IMF of a region is, you need to understand its star formation history. And the way I'm basically writing it down is the following. So let this sigma be some kind of the number of stars that you form per time interval, per mass interval, maybe depending on the location in some cloud or whatever. It can be a complicated function. So in principle, it has all these dependencies, maybe on the location, and God knows what kind of other dependencies you have. Maybe you can want to put in metallicity. And then usually, what is being done is that you say you can separate all these functions, and only then you can basically derive the individual functions. So if you separate it into some term that is our mass function, all right, we got that. You want to separate it into some star formation history, and then maybe some function that is telling you as a function of location in the star formation cloud, how many stars you've been forming, and so on and so forth. So in principle, that is a complicated function. But we make the simplifying assumption, and then we can really work with it.
The easiest would be to look at a star cluster, right?
I'm coming to that, yes. I just want to get the general picture, because I'll need it later on. All right. And if you know this initial distribution function of stars, you can also then ask, okay, so if you're looking into a star formation region, what is the present day distribution of all these objects? And that then turns out to be basically a simple integration. It's all just power law mass functions. So let me denote that now by the present day mass distribution. And this is then going to be proportional to, let's forget about the spatial dependence of this function. Let's say it's uniform, basically. Then you want to basically collect all the stars that have been forming. So you collect all stars from 0 up to h capital T in the past. And you're summing up all the stars that have been formed via your initial mass function and the star formation rate at a time t. You have to put in a correction function that is taking into account then that stars die at some point or that you lose them. And this function is basically dependent on the time and the mass. And for this, you want to integrate the whole thing. Okay? You can write down the same thing for the age distribution of stars. But now you're integrating the same function here, but of course over the mass. All right? So simple thing, and then you would know what the ages of the stars are in any region. One word about this function in here. I've been writing it in this notation because I thought it is easier to get how it works, and then this would be just a Heaviside step function, but if you like, you can also write it as a convolution of IMF and star formation history, if you prefer, I prefer that view, but I thought it's easier in here. So this guy is going to be just a Heaviside step function, as I said, and this is the lifetime of a star of mass M minus the current time t. You plug that in, and then you can compute these numbers. Of course, this is only proportional, so you need to have your normalization constant, but you can normalize, for example, the total number of stars that you have in any region, and then these normalization constants are gone. Okay? Let's come now to the most simple case, namely a star cluster.
Okay, I know you know this, but I'm no longer capable of not saying, of course, there are binary interactions, and your present day mass function is not your initial mass function, even if stars don't die.
Let's come to that later. Let's do the easy stuff first. For a coeval stellar population, you basically replace your star formation history by a delta function, and that makes this integral really easy. Or just say the above integral. So that is coeval. Well, so this is basically about the initial mass function. You can get exactly the initial mass function from the present day distribution of stars that you have in your cluster. And it is just modified by, divide it the other way. The present day distribution is then just the same as your initial mass distribution, but you have a step function in the end. And the step function depends on the age of your coeval stellar population. So what it's telling you is there's a turnoff in your cluster. This is just telling the turnoff, so it's cutting your power law mass function at some mass, and that's it. All right. So the next.
Just 1 second. So just step back. So this is a distribution of stars at this current age, right? The C would. No.
Zeta?
Zm. Now K is the age of the currently present stars, right? Mm-hmm. But there's no integration for.
That is taken care by the star formation history. So I think this integral is more straightforward if you think about it. So we start basically at present day. At the present day, we are asking what is the star formation rate today? Say 2 stars or 2 solar masses per year or whatever units you're playing here. And then you multiply that basically with your mass function.
That
is giving you the contribution from all the stellar populations up back down to time t, which could be the Hubble time, the age of a galaxy.
Is it the distribution of the initial masses or the current masses?
This is initial masses.
Yes.
And then it gives you the current masses.
Okay. So we're going to pretend there's no mass loss.
Yes.
Okay.
So we just
can you like give some index to the current H and the initial? The symbols are too similar.
is lambda, is it the lifetime or what is it?
Yes.
What is lambda?
Lambda is lifetime.
This is exactly it. Then just the lifetime. And so you're basically asking, for example, say 1 giga year ago, the star formation rate was 10 whatever, and you're asking how many stars at present day do I have from 1 giga year ago at, for example, a mass of 100.
What's that goes in the K? The current age or the initial? For P at T.
No, if this is time T, this is today.
Okay, Fabian, I understand about Z.
And your function S of T can be anything, yeah?
No. Sorry. Number one, could you please zeta, which are on the left and the right part of integral, distinguished by some index, given like the initial EI and observed, like, or current HT? Because otherwise...
You have two different vectors there. They're not the same
vector. Okay, I mean, I understand, but it's really nice. You can describe it, I really have a hard time to distinguish it. Okay? So then, and so what is for the current age, you have also initial.
The T is sort of the initial age.
And the mass function, I think she's asking. What mass function do you use in KT?
This is the initial mass function.
Yeah. Now
this
I can recognize it.
Okay. All right. Are you now all confused, or?
So the one is that DM, which is this zeta, and the other one is C, I guess, whatever. I can never remember the Greek letters. I don't speak Greek. It's Russian letters. So that DM is of a cluster with a certain star formation history. This is something that's the universal law, the average over a whole bunch of stars in the galaxy. So that's the difference. I mean, both of them are the NDMs, but now this one is just the observed distribution of stars in a cluster which have some given star formation history.
Yes.
Is that right? Whereas the other one is basically
the birth distribution.
Birth of stars, okay.
The birth distribution of masses of stars at whatever time, T.
That's the INF.
And then you're integrating over all the contributions.
Okay.
It could make up your stellar population, for example, a galactic disk, or a star cluster, or anything else. And this is only then for a coeval stellar population, where the star formation history basically is a delta function. Yeah? So it's a delta function somewhere here, and you only form one burst of stars at one time, and then this time basically sets the mass at which your mass function is cut.
Yeah, so that's the delta function. Okay. But NDT is the total number of stars in the cluster.
Excuse me?
The NDT, the K, that's the total number of stars in the cluster. The change in the total number of stars in the cluster per unit time.
No, this is the number of stars with an HT in your star cluster today.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, you can make a distribution of the masses of the stars that you have in your cluster today, and you can ask what is their H distribution as well.
Okay.
This is telling you basically when these stars have formed in the past.
Okay.
But some will have, as I said, some have expired. Okay. They have black holes or whatever, and they're missing.
T is age, not. And that's the point about the T in the end. Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. This bit here. And let's go to the. Next, more complicated case, and that is if the star formation history was constant in time. And we can also evaluate it at integral. It's also pretty easy. So this function S of t is just going to be any constant, and you can take out the integration. And what you're ending up with is your distribution of the stars that you see today, in mass, today in the cluster, is basically going to be given by their IMF, but here multiplied with their lifetime. Okay? So if you know you have a cluster of, say, a star, the galactic disk, and you may want to assume that the star formation history in the galactic disk was constant over time, and you measure the distribution of all the mass distribution of all the stars that you've got, you divide it by the lifetime of each of these things, and you get the IMF, if the star formation history was constant. And that's, for example, something that is usually used if you derive the IMF from a mixed stellar population. Then you make the assumption of a constant star formation history.
How much does the assumption affect your result? I mean, how reliable are these results?
Oh, it can affect it quite severely. Imagine you have a... Let's make a simple thing. This is star formation history. And let's say it is continuous here, but there's sort of a jump. These jumps are basically defining then some time t0 and time t1. Well, say it is a continuous cooking of stars, and then at some point the whole thing bursts. You have many more stars during this time window. And this time window then is going to add the same bump on your present day distribution of masses. Yeah, so in principle, it's your Zika function, present day distribution of all these stars. It's going to be some kind of power law. Then we're going to have basically some kind of bump in here. So this bump at the lower masses is basically the decrease at the older ages. This is basically at a mass where a star has the lifetime of T1, and this is where a star has a lifetime of T0.
What do you want to shout? Because stars evolve at a different time scale.
Yes.
So if you start with, say, a sharp rise and an exponential decline, you carry that along the same way with a...
So you can get, for example, such a feature in your mass function. So you can make quite some wrong estimates of the IMF if you don't get the star formation history correct. Another interesting thing in here is if you just approximate the lifetime of the stars as we usually do, it is sort of just given by the any mass luminosity relation. So if you say this function is something like mass to the power of 1 minus x, and x is just a mass luminosity exponent, then you see that your present-day distribution of masses is going to be proportional to 1 minus gamma minus x. So x can be different now. For extremely massive stars near the Eddington limit, x is basically 1. So you see in constant star formation scenario, your present-day distribution would be basically the same as the initial mass distribution. But if you go to low-mass stars, x can be, for example, 4. And then the exponent, or the power law exponent of your mass distribution here that you see today, it can be totally different. Yeah, so don't be confused if you see present-day mass distribution of a galactic disk. That exponent is going to be far away from Salpeter. All right, and then the more complicated case, let me write it down here, because we may need it later on. So imagine now the star formation history can be anything. And you just know it is not going to be constant, it's not going to be a delta burst, so what do you do then? So what you then need, if you want to infer the IMF, is also the age distribution of stars. You need this bit over here. If you have got both from your measurements, present day distribution of the ages of stars and of the masses, you can then again try to disentangle the two. And one way of doing it, over here, one way of doing it is sort of in the first step, choose your IMF. For example, choose different IMF exponents. Once you set the IMF, you can go and compute the star formation history. And the star formation history then can be just computed from here. It shows your IMF. You can pull that out of your integral, and you get it from your observed distribution. So this is going to be, say, proportional to this distribution of observed ages that you got from your observations. Well, and then you divide it by this integral over your IMF model. You have your function giving me the lifetime of stars in here. This integral, all right. So at this point, we have the star formation history for an assumption of on our IMF. So you can continue in the next step. And for this star formation history, and for your IMF choice, you can predict what is the distribution of masses that you should see today. So this is going to give you the zeta just from the above equation. And that can be then compared to your observations, and you can see how well of a job did you do. Is it sort of basically working, or is it absolutely bogus? And then you continue the whole thing. Compared to the observations, and then you see probably, okay, this is not going to fit really nicely, so maybe I will start again with A and change my IMF model, and you iterate until you find then the best fit. Okay.
So, maybe I'm one confused. Way. It looks like you've taken the K out of the integral. I'm sorry, the S out of the integral.
Yes.
And I'm not sure how you do that.
Well, this is an integral over mass. So I can, and this function is only dependent on t. So I can pull it out of the integral and define. But this, again, this is an important step here. It relies on the assumption that you can separate this function into individual things that are independent of each other.
Okay.
If for some reason the IMF depends on the age or the position in some star formation cloud, you cannot do that anymore. Okay? All right.
Fabian, since you said for this you need to measure the ages, how would you typically do that with isoperms?
Let me come to that in a moment, because I want to show you an example where we've been exactly going through this complicated third case and trying to get what we have. Maybe one word about past IMF measurements. So if we want to constrain the high mass end of the IMF, we need to find a star cluster that is well populated, so that we actually have all these high mass stars. Ideally, we want to have, of course, a cluster, because then life is really going to be easy. You can basically derive the IMF directly, and we just have to play more or less with the turnoff mass at some point. And there are, of course, several clusters. And, well, let me maybe start. Well, my brainstorm list of clusters that I could come up with in the galaxy that we could use. Well, there's Arches, we have Quintuplet, they're both in the galactic center. So it's not really ideal if you want to observe massive stars. We have the Westerlund clusters. In the Carina Nebula, Well, we have Orion next to us. That might be something to use, Cygnus OV2, where Trumpler 14, 16. And so these are all sort of star clusters that we could use, but they all have a big problem. Most of them are basically hiding behind a lot of dust. And in many cases here, you have to observe these clusters in the infrared. And you know, we're looking into massive stars now, and you sort of try to guess parameters of massive stars from the infrared. It's really not the ideal wavelength regime where you want to play this game. This is putting quite some uncertainties. And maybe some further complications. How do you convert? So usually these clusters are observed purely with photometry. So you get maybe a J, H, K, or whatever photometry of these objects. And how do you convert that into masses? If you want to convert it into masses, you need to have some assumption on the age of your star clusters. Because in the CMD, at least, massive stars, in any CMD, even if it's blue light, visual light, whatever, in that CMD, all the massive stars just are lying on one line. And you don't see a turnoff, for example. That's going to be highly complicated. Another important ingredient, of course, in all these star clusters is that you have to get some feeling for the cluster dynamics going on. You're probably only going to observe maybe the core of some of these star clusters. It was the case for Arches and Quintuplet, for example, initially. And in the core, you see a mass-segregated core, so the mass distribution that you infer from such measurements is not going to be the IMF, so you have to correct for that. You have, of course, cluster ejections from all of these clusters. and probably you're going to eject your most massive cluster members, and it's just all making life pretty tough.
What's the time scale for mass segregation variant clusters? I mean, you really already observing the mass segregation of dynamical, or its initial mass segregation mean that the mass formation was different?
It's both. It then again depends on how the cluster formed, for example. Does it form already mass segregated, or do you wait for it to happen? But otherwise, I guess the mass segregation is on a time scale, on some cluster crossing time scale, and that can be short again. At least in Arches, for example, this is supposed to be a really young star cluster, and you see mass segregation. So the mass function, for example, in the inner regions is much, much shallower than in the outer regions.
No, but it's mass segregation maybe because we've just been formed that way. So can you remove that?
Well, you can try to remove it if you manage to find all members of the Arches star cluster that are sort of in the surrounding field and then try to be complete again.
No, what I mean, can you remove completely the hypothesis that the mass of stars which are formed are not the same depending on what was initial density of the cloud, and the density of the cloud was not the same everywhere in your protocol, right?
You can't. You have to live with it. You don't know exactly what the cluster formation scenario was. I didn't write down the complications, but there's one really nice paper if you want to look a bit deeper into this. And this is by Weich, probably, that's how to pronounce the first author. So this 2013, it's an object paper. And they're making a pretty nice analysis of how many stars do you need to constrain an IMF photometry to some accuracy or to some precision. And their final verdict is that basically the average uncertainty on your mass exponent that you could realistically obtain is of the order of 0.35. And they also have been looking, this is one sigma error bar, and they've been also looking through the literature and basically saying that in 3/4 of all the cases, this uncertainty has been much, much underestimated because people have not been doing their statistics correctly. Keep that in mind. It is difficult to get these mass function slopes from all of these stellar populations. All right. And on that note, I'd like to now on, I can really not draw these view graphs anymore. So I'm going back to a couple of slides to show you the real star formation histories and things like that. But before I do that, here's a figure from a recent 2010 review on the IMF from Nate Bastian. And this is all this low mass end that is really uninteresting for us. The interesting bit is going to be here. And this is at the time, at 2010, I think what Nate thought were robust measurements of IMF indices. And you see, in terms of mass, we may go up to 100 solar masses. And there are not many clusters or many associations or things where you can really constrain the IMF index. That's a point I would like to make here. And I'd like to remind you that these inferences here are from photometry, and often enough from infrared photometry than of massive stars in some really far away galactic disk kind of star cluster. We have, of course, one problem, as I also alluded initially to. If we want to measure the IMF index in this high mass range, we really need a lot of massive stars. And they are rare. Yeah, 0.5% of the whole population is going to be in massive stars. But we have a star formation complex in the nearby universe, in the local group, where there are many, many massive stars. And this is 30 Dorados in the Large Magellanic Cloud. So this is sort of a bigger picture of 30 Dor. This is the Tarantula Nebula over here, I think supernova 1987A, that has sort of occurred somewhere in this range. It is massive, it is huge, gigantic. Its diameter here is of the order of 200 parsecs. And if I'm to put in the Orion Nebula to scale into 30 Dor, that's where it would be, yeah? This is to scale, okay? So we can have many, many Orions sort of basically hiding in 30 Dor, and we probably would not really notice it. It is sort of the brightest H2 region in the local group, just because of all of these massive objects sitting in here. And therefore, it is basically a prototype for any more distant starburst. So if you want to understand distant starbursts, say in the high redshift universe or in galaxies or whatever, this is the place to look into to see how things maybe evolve in there. Because we can really individually resolve all the stars here. And there are in total more than 1,000 massive stars. And by massive, I really mean OB stars or Wolf-Rayet stars and anything else. So we have more than 1,000 in the whole region. This is a fantastic sample. And among these massive stars, we have some of the most massive stars that we know of today. This is sort of the four objects that Paul Crowther found in 2010 in the core of this R136 star cluster. The most massive of those is supposed to be 300 solar masses initially. And there are four of these beasts. And this region in general is rich of record holders. I have a sort of quick tour through all the record holders that we got. There's the fastest rotating star that we know of. And so that's an ideal environment if you want to understand maybe stars and also star formation. Well, this is just a side note. If you take a stellar mass in here and maybe you're able to collapse it to form one star cluster in the end, maybe that could be a sort of low mass globular cluster. This is sort of the same region again. And I just want to highlight two sub-regions in here. This is NGC 2060. This is sort of an area in 30 Dorados where you see many young stars. So that's what people have been claiming. This is a young region. You see sort of an overabundance of O stars in here. And then there is this massive central complex, NGC 2017, 70. And this is sort of just a little zoom in here. And in the center of that part, that is where the R136 star cluster sits. Well, you see further star clusters here, for example, which is the O1, but it's sort of an older star cluster. It still has a couple of V stars in there, but its age is maybe 15, 20 million years. We don't know it exactly. And there's some other regions of sort of star clusters around. So this is this one complex that I was mentioning, which has an overabundance of young objects. There are two record holders in here. On the one hand here, that is where this guy up here, this is the fastest rotating star that we know of at the moment, or one of the most fastest rapid rotators, VFTS 102. And it's at a low metallicity region, so maybe that is actually a long-duration gamma-ray burst candidate, who knows. There's also the most energetic and fastest rotating young pulsar in this region, just sitting in here, and that is often thought to be sort of the center of this area. I have to show you that. Unfortunately, this is in German. But this is fantastic. So this is from basically one of these daily calendars that you sometimes can get. And this star, VFTS 102, the star that was rotating on speed, it had some drugs. But this is not really the most funny bit. The most funny bit is in here. So I have to translate that for you. It says, okay, this is 25 times the mass of the sun. And at the pole, the star is rotating 500 kilometers per second.
Ah.
At the pole. And now, at the equator, the whole thing is supposed to rotate with 2 million kilometers per second. I have no idea. But when I saw it for the first time, I was like, wow, a VFTS star made it into a daily calendar. But yeah, I don't know. Anyhow, this is really a record holder, but it's not that fast. I already told you this is sort of where this other record holding star cluster sits, R136. And well, some of those guys in here, this is this 300 solar mass star that Paul Crowther apparently found. And already, just this region is extremely complex. And it's just a sort of slightly different image of the region. It is not a single and simple stellar population. It's really not. So you find helium seeking stars all over the place that range in age from 0 up to 30 million years. Already in here. All right, I've been telling you that. There's so something like a northeast clump that Elena Zabi and colleagues figured out is separate from this cluster in here, and they've been even suggesting that the two structures might be in the process of merging. We do see ongoing star formation in some of these knots surrounding in here, so these are really hot, sort of some hot stuff that is just lighting up the nebula in here. And we even have carbon-rich Wolf-Rayet stars basically sitting on top of this R136 star cluster, and there's another one up here. So this is not a single stellar population. There's many stuff going on. And that is where basically the VLT Flame Strangelos survey comes into the game. This is an ESO large program. The PI is Chris Evans. And within this program, we have obtained multi-epoch optical spectra of about 1,000 massive stars. So we've been trying to get as many spectra of as many stars possible, and also in a multi-epoch spectra, because we wanted to figure out which of those guys are binaries and which are single stars. So the Flames instrument has been used, and the thing I would like to draw your attention to is that the Flames fibers have a finite size on the sky of 1.2 arc seconds. And it can happen, of course, that you have several sources contributing to one spectrum in one of these fibers. And also because of this limitation, we did not put any of these fibers on top of the core of R136. We just give you some horrible composite spectrum, which is probably also nice to study, but it's not going to tell you anything about one star. Okay. The whole sample has only one limit, if you like, and this is a magnitude limit. So all objects are brighter than the 17th magnitude in V-band. That's how stars have been selected. Yes, I think that's all I want to say about that.
What does that correspond to, this is modulus? What does that correspond to in terms of absolute magnitude?
Right, so the distance is 50 kiloparsecs. I think the distance modulus was 18.6. So this is a sample of stars that we've got. This is a sample of stars that I'll be working with in basically the couple of the following slides. This is again sort of the whole region. That is where R136 sits in the center. This is the other region that I've been highlighting beforehand, NGC 2060. The pulsar is just sitting exactly in here. That's how I chose the center of the region. As I said, the dense region exactly in the core of R136 has been excluded in the survey because you can just not distinguish any individual star in here. And not for all of the VFTS targets. So all the VFTS targets are basically this little grayish symbols in here. But for all of them, could we get really robust spectral modeling of the spectra that we get. In many cases, the spectra are composite. For example, you have two stars just contributing to the light. You have binaries, and we identified the binaries. So for all of these objects, it's just difficult to obtain any physical parameters from spectral modeling. If you translate our magnitude limit into a mass limit or a completeness fraction in terms of mass, we are roughly at 15 solar masses. I'll go and show you that in a second in the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. But what it leaves us with is basically a sample of 450 massive stars. And for each star, we have robust atmospheric parameters in the sense that we have the spectrum, and the spectrum was individually modeled with state-of-the-art atmosphere codes for different groups, depending on what kind of star you've had.
So the selection effect against systems which give you composite spectra, how does that translate into, I don't know, bioluminescence or something? Which things are you excluding because you can't get robust parameters?
Exactly. So what we're going to have is a sample of apparently single stars. And I'm really saying apparently, because some of these objects, of course, might be the product of some binary interaction that we just simply cannot detect the companion anymore. Some of them could be in really wide binaries, and then you don't see radio velocity variations, or the radio velocity variations that we could detect. And there's a second selection criterion, that is, we have the sample of apparently single stars outside this dense cluster core. If you like, field objects, but they're also pretty close to the cluster itself. Okay, that is our selection effect, if you like. And with this data, we can make a beautiful Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. So each of these data points is now one of these robust spectra that we've got, and we've modeled the spectrum of each of these stars and obtained, and for example, temperature and luminosity. Down here, you see the magnitude limit. So if you translate this magnitude limit basically into a real mass, you may say, okay, above 10 solar masses, that's sort of where we start to see stars. But it's not to say that we are complete in this region. We're really complete maybe starting at 15 solar masses. And you see that, for example, if you make a plot of mass distribution of all these objects, it's leveling off at 15 solar masses. And just some of these objects hiding maybe a bit further deep in the nebula, and you don't see them anymore. But if once we're above 15 solar masses, then we're complete in all the massive star content.
Why are there a bunch of old giants on the main sequence?
Oh, let's not get into that.
Solar masses.
You mean this part here?
Yeah. That's, what is that?
This is going to be recorded, right?
Well, then don't answer.
say, the spectral classification was made before we got the parameters of the stars. And there come some objects where apparently it is ambiguous whether it is going to be a dwarf or a giant. And there were some features in the spectrum that led people to classify it as a giant. But I think from the position of the Hirschsprung-Russell diagram, as you say, this is clearly a dwarf. I'll leave that to the spectral classification.
What is a dwarf or a star? A normal star. I mean, a dwarf would be something like an obvious star, right? Or a dwarf. We don't really mean a compass star.
This is really the old
main sequence star.
Main sequence. Dwarf, giants. No, but you
well,
call them
standard
an 0005 object? 0005? That is an old dwarf. That's
05. But those are classic.
Dwarf means main sequence.
Yes. So yeah. Oh, 05.
What's main sequence?
No, it means dwarf.
No,
it means both. In the 5 is a main sequence, and that is a dwarf.
But from the spectral classification point of view, I'm pretty sure people will say this is a dwarf. That's how we classify it. Yeah. And you reinterpret it, because this is a theory group, as being a main sequence star.
I think you should cover up the legend with a little white box in PowerPoint. So do you have is there UV data? I'm just curious about the statement that the luminosities are measured X accurately. Is this actually a bolometric luminosity measurement, or this is a fit to models that blah blah blah.
It is so you get the best spectrum for a star and you fit it in an optical range.
Exactly.
But then you have basically an SED, if you like, of the star. And from that, with your magnitude, with a couple of magnitudes that you get from different surveys, you can scale it to a total luminosity of a star. For most of the objects, we do not have UV data.
Right, okay.
What temperature is the bistability
to that? 25,000.
So we have a group of yellow things. Are they sitting roughly at the bistability zone?
Yes.
So just below these things.
Yeah.
Bistability jump is first.
Yeah.
Let me maybe continue with to the point where I really want to get to. And then we can. I'm happy to discuss many features in this Hirschsprung-Russell diagram. There's many more to explore, and the longer I leave it on here, I guess you'll figure it out. Let me say. We do not only have temperatures and luminosity for all of these stars. We also have surface gravities, Vsin-I measurements, and in many cases, chemical abundances, surface chemical abundances. Luminosity, log G, temperature, and Vsin-I, those are the four quantities that will be used to derive the mass and the age of each of these stars in this Hirschsprung-Russell diagram. One note on these sort of red giants in here. Put them aside. I'll not use them in the following. But I will be using a mass cut of 15 solar masses. So if you continue with your mass cut of 15 solar masses, maybe somewhere in here, if a 15 solar mass star makes it to the red giant branch. So if I'm cutting out those red giants, I might be missing four objects in here.
Yeah, but the 15 solar mass star go up at the end.
Exactly. So maybe we're not missing missing any. But this is at most, that's sort of the stuff that we at most miss. Once we cut that out, it's just difficult to get masses and ages for these red giants from the data that we have. All right.
You can throw those out.
Can you actually go back? So which of these is the binary that maybe is chemically homogeneous because it's a little too hot?
Well, there's one.
Is it this? Yeah,
here?
Okay.
Exactly. This is not a binary. This is a Wolf-Rayet star. And the question is actually. Whether that is a chemically homogeneous evolving star or whether it is just an inflated Wolf-Rayet star.
Okay.
Depending on, I guess, on who you ask, you get a different answer on what it is.
Is that the Hertz Fredette we're seeing there?
This year, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
What are the
blue, the grey triangles pointing up in that region, because they're not marked on the legend.
Oh, I called all of these beasts basically late type.
Okay.
And I marked them in grey because I just derived the ages and masses of these stars in a slightly different way.
Okay. So what's the difference between the triangle and the circle?
The triangle, this is again a giant
it's just the color
okay. indicating that later on the star images are derived in a slightly different way. I'll continue now. So we've been using all these the atmospheric parameters, so four in total, and then we've been feeding them through Bonsai, which is a Bayesian method. And with this Bayesian method, we can get all these observables at the same time, include the uncertainties that we get from spectral modeling, and match them against our stellar models. And from the stellar models, or I should say, we of course, put also a priori or prior knowledge into the analysis. And from the stellar models, we then get full probability distributions, posterior probability distributions, for example, for the initial mass and the age of a star. And we have that for all of these 450 objects. The models or this method can robustly identify these cases where the stellar atmospheric parameters do not match to our stellar models. So we can figure them out and then throw them out in the end. And this code and the stellar models have been tested with eclipsing binaries. Just to put some trust into that. There's a web interface if you want to play with it. If you have your favorite star, you want to match it against stellar models, go to the web page, type your numbers in, and you'll get full posterior distributions of whatever you want. Okay? And we've been using this code to basically get it, and this is just one example. So that's the input. This is VFTSO16. It is probably the most massive runaway that we know of. This is its luminosity. We have some error bars, temperatures, gravity, the Vsin I. If you feed that into this Bayesian technique, you get a posterior probability distribution for the initial mass in this case, but we have the same thing in age and in many other physical parameters. And the really key point I want to make is we do get proper error bars on this. Yeah, we properly propagate the error bars from the spectral modeling into initial masses and ages. We get that basically for free.
What kind of assumption about mass loss goes in there?
This is the models that we're using are Ines Brott and Karen Köhler's models. So it's basically Wink mass loss for the main sequence. I think it is Nieuwenhuysen if you go beyond the main sequence, and then probably for the Wolf-Rayet stage, Lucas Lamas. But in this case, this is only for the main sequence bit, so we're in an easy stripe where basically the Wink mass loss rate is giving us the mass loss in here. All right, and as I said, we have all these probability distributions for all of these stars. So what we can do now is we can stack up all the age distributions that we have. So we have also the same thing for ages and the same thing for the initial masses. We can stack them up for all of our targets and obtain exactly this kind of present-day distribution of age and mass. Just that you can see that maybe.
Fabian, what do you do in respect with the star formation prior? The star formation history.
Prior, or the age prior that we put into the whole game initially is uniform, because we have no information. That's the best you could do. Or if you like it, the same as if you do a maximum likelihood analysis. That's your implicit assumption. All right, so let's have a look first only into this blue curve. And this blue curve is basically if I'm adding up all the age distributions that I get for all the individual stars. And in our sample of stars above 15 solar masses, we have now roughly 250 objects. Initially, we had something like 450 stars with robust parameters. But as the IMF is telling you, most of these guys will be rather in the low mass regime. So we're left with 250 objects above 15 solar masses. That is where VFTS is complete. This is the blue curve. Forget about the orange, yellowish, reddish thing here. The errors that you do see on this curve are bootstrapped 1-sigma error bars. And this is supposed to capture uncertainties regarding the sample selection. So imagine in the VFTS, people have been choosing maybe a different star in the region, then we would have just a different stellar parameters in the whole game. So if you want to play the sample selection effect, that is the error bar that you get from that. It is not the error bar that you get from the error bars on ages and masses, because they are already in this distribution. All right? And then, using this distribution and using the mass distribution, which is this blue curve with the black thing with the blue error bar in here, we can play exactly this game. We can make an assumption on the IMF model, compute what the star formation history for each IMF model would be, compared to a distribution of initial masses that we have observed, and then reiterate until we find the best fit to the IMF.
But how do you deal with the fact that you're using half of the stars for your IMF?
Well, I guess the plain answer is, of course, you hope that half of stars that you've been selecting has the same initial distribution as the other half that you have been removing, because you can just not get your hands on stellar formicas.
There is no theoretical thing which will lead you to the fact that the binaries will have to have absolutely the same distribution of masses, because they are more like the non-massive stars may be more likely to capture stars, but they're also more likely to start. I mean, I don't understand how you can suggest that it will be totally the same.
To make sure I understand the question, this is about the fact that
only half of the stars go into this analysis.
I see.
But again, they get stuck up because they don't fit.
No, for the binaries, we know that the composite spectrum. If you model a composite spectrum as being a single star, you have to get wrong parameters, and so they're out of the game.
Which they would not classify them.
So this is what, I guess, once we are able to disentangle spectra of the binaries, we can actually try to answer this question. But be reminded, binaries have been ignored in any IMF determination whatsoever so far.
No, I understand. I'm not telling that you're doing worse than the previous. I'm just asking how you're dealing with that with your head.
So we are dealing it in the same sense as any person that would do population synthesis. There you would assume that the primary in all your binaries has the same distribution as the single star that you put in your distribution. And if you make that assumption, then you're fine here again.
On the other hand, you can know that those stars which you observe now, single stars, right? Because you detected them. And if you assume that 100% of being binaries,
Let me get to that later on, okay? So that is something that we can handle.
I can maybe guess where you're going with, you know, what binaries might do to this, but just to be clear, that deriving the age is putting it on the HR diagram using a single star model. So if a massive star is the result of a merger, you're going to get a bump, right?
You're way ahead of
I'm just trying to understand to make sure where the age comes from.
You're absolutely right. So these ages are apparent ages.
Yeah.
Inferred from single star models, although there might be binary products in here.
Yeah.
And we have to worry about it.
Yeah.
And we do worry about it. I'll tell you in a second how we see it. Exactly. So the point I would like to make in this diagram, so if we're playing this game, come up with the best fit IMF. Once we have the best fit IMF, we can also show what is the best fit star formation history. That is this red curve in here. It's going to tell you that, for example, in the last 10 million years, there were 140 stars in 32, at least 140 that have been basically ended their life. You can compute what a peak star formation rate is, but that is not too interesting. I'm plotting here also the ratio of what we observe compared to the best fit IMF model that we have and compared to a Sol-Peter IMF model. And you see that this ratio for our best fit, well, that is fine. It's consistent with basically one. But you see that the Sol-Peter model is sort of getting worse and worse in explaining the high mass end of the mass function. And, well, if you want to look at it, the point where the two start to diverge, that is roughly around here. And that corresponds to a mass of 30 solar masses. Okay? That's where the problem may start for that model.
It seems that drawing a being fixated on power law slopes and stuff like that it is missing the result that is hitting you in the face there, that there is a break in the IMF at about, what is that? No, not there.
In the middle.
It's, what is it, 50 solar masses?
Yes.
You mean
here?
Yeah, I mean, that is, you know,
Take away these models that you've got on top already guiding your eye, and you won't see that as strikingly anymore.
Yes, I will. Yeah, I can still see it. I'm taking away the
If you move this part, then you have a similar break here, right? I mean, the whole thing is just wobbling around. So I'm not sure how much, in terms of statistical significance, you can interpret into this kind of feature in this part. I'm with you in terms of seeing that there is something going on. Let's go to the interpretation in the next.
But this is in favor of having there be more than you would the normal standard, more massive stars than the solar system.
Exactly. Let me get exactly to that, because that's the next two.
Sorry, just one last question. Does the error bars on the previous plot include both the measurement uncertainty and the simple Poisson uncertainty in the fact that, after all, you have only... On the fact that, at the right-hand edge, you clearly have very few objects. Yes. So there must be just big error bars because, you only have a few objects with masses above 100 solar masses.
That's right.
I think the answer is no, because in the blue, if you treat each in the left-hand
part... The black curve itself has all the uncertainties on initial masses and in edges that have been propagated through from the spectral modeling. The blue error range on here is accounting for the sample selection effects, meaning the Poisson process.
Perhaps panel A, right? If I treat each 1 mega-year bin, right, the plus or minus, the bootstrap errors are much smaller than what I get from the square root of the number and everything. Okay. I mean, 40, square root of 40 is much bigger than that blue thing. Is that?
The square root of 46. That's it.
Let's do that later on, okay?
How many? I'm just surprised by this very small error bar on the right side.
How many 200 solar mass stars are there?
Exactly.
Well,
one.
The most massive object. No. The most massive object. What?
300.
Yeah. Supposedly.
Just stick with it.
This is sort of the object that we have in the high mass. We have error bars. So the most massive guy is probably going to be probably this one. And if you do the math, it comes out as something like 200 plus minus something. But the number of stars that are sort of hitting this 200 limit, well, this could be 3.
Yeah, so I think the question is, why isn't there an order unity error bar then? Maybe there isn't.
I guess it's not a unit, right? It's a huge error bar in here.
Well, yeah, because the number of stars could either be 10... it could either be 10 to minus 1 or essentially 10 times smaller, right? When you go down to that part of the diagram, the error bar gets big enough that it's almost as big.
Also, the eye tends to measure the error bar perpendicular to the black line.
It's a log plot.
The number of stars that you have sort of in this regime, right? You multiply it basically with the number of stars that we have in the mass function. It can be 0 or it can be 1. That is basically what this thing is telling you.
I know, but I'm just saying that...
And the error bar is exactly capturing it.
The error bars look small to the eye because it's a log-log. It's a log plot.
Yes.
A log-log plot. And so when the error bars get to the point where you can go from 10 to minus 1 down to 10 to minus 2, or potentially could be 0, really you're saying you don't know the number of stars in that bin.
Yes. So we can probably say we know the number of stars below 200 solar masses from our sample. And this is not including yet these stars in the core of R136.
Yeah.
And up to in this range, so I did not put numbers on the curve, because I have also a figure that's basically telling you how many stars there are really in each of these bins. But between 100 and 200 solar masses, there will be of the order of 5-ish stars from just the Hirschman-Russell diagram. Yeah? So we have statistics in here. It's not that they're not there. If you play the game and try to infer what is the best IMF model that we have, and we're playing with power law, you can even get a full PDF probability distribution function for the IMF slope. The index that we found for 30 Dorados is 1.9, plus minus error bars. The error bars are pretty large because of all the uncertainties that we do have, or given the total number of stars that are in our sample.
And this is still assuming that there are no mergers or anything. This is just assuming.
Yes. It's all playing the game with single stars. And you see then that the Sarpita IMF index would fall into the 2-sigma regime in here. And if you worry about the point where basically our best fit IMF model and the Sarpita model started to diverge, that it was around 30 solar masses, and if you then compare only the number of stars above 30 solar masses that each of these two models would predict, yeah, this is for different IMF slopes, And then this is a number of massive stars above 30 solar masses. We have our observed number. This observed number has some error bar. This is a 1 sigma error bar. Well, this is a 95% confidence level. We can predict from all these different IMF power law models how many stars they would predict to be there. And that depends, of course, on the IMF index. A Sir Peter IMF, for example, would predict that they are of the order of, well, what is it, 56, 57 stars, but observed are 75.
Again, your 1 sigma error bar is only barely consistent with only quasar, not anything else.
Yeah, but that's fine.
So there's no other error, like quasar dominates your uncertainty.
The sample selection is dominating, yes.
The number of stars with this mass was calculated as compared to what? As to the number of stars down to 15 solar masses, as to the total number of stars?
No, this is the number of stars that you have above 30 solar masses for different assumptions on your IMF.
Yeah, but expected for what? For this size of... I don't understand.
So you
integrated order of what?
So you... You make an assumption on your IMF. You get what your star formation history for that IMF model is.
You have some size of a cluster. You have some mass of a cluster. You have some number of stars of different masses. What's your total?
It's normalized to the total number of stars that we observe in 32. So there's 247 objects that we have.
So down to 15 solar masses. That's what was my question.
Yes, that is setting the normalization of the whole thing.
Okay.
Exactly.
So,
sure.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then for that normalization, you can ask how many stars above 30 solar masses would you have? If you make several assumptions on what the real IMF is that has forming.
So it's only comparing the high end IMF between above 30 solar masses and above 15 solar masses.
Yes, that's what we're playing with. Exactly. That's what we have. I mean, we have no information about 0.08 solar mass stars. Yeah. So what you find in here is that you have basically an excess of massive stars above 30 solar masses of the order of 18. Plus minus 6.
If I count the width of the blue, it's smaller than 16 across. And the blue is higher than 64, so that's smaller than possible.
He's saying that 75, the blue is 75 plus or minus 6, right? The 1 sigma is plus or minus 6. And square root of 75 is more than 6, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But let's get around around that later on, okay? I think this is just a confusion about what kind of statistics you should be playing here.
Well, I think
the Poisson is the right thing to do or not.
Condition you're using when making those nice smooth curves when you actually have distinct counts. But
exactly. I think that is exactly the difference here. I'm working with PDFs and not. Anyhow, let's continue from here. Okay. This is the number of excess stars that we have that there is compared to a Sol-Peter model in 30 Dorados, only above 30 solar masses. So the Sol-Peter model would underpredict the number of massive stars that we see here by 18. And if you take this error bar, this is an incredibly high significance. And if you put it into percentage numbers, basically, so there's one-third of the stars missing if you assume a Sol-Peter IMF. Okay. So if you're playing in a high mass end of the mass function, this is a lot of stars that are missing here. Well, if you convert that into a confidence, then you say, Sol-Peter IMF, we're sure with 99.4% confidence that the Sol-Peter model is not explaining this large number of massive stars above 30 solar masses in 30 Dorados.
I'd like to just point out that during the last fall, I spent every day looking at predictions about the probability of who would be elected president, and many, many of the quotes of Hillary winning at a confidence of over 99%. People who are really smart mathematicians and statisticians.
I guess at least this is trying to predict the past rather than predict the future.
Yep. So on paper, there's nothing I can do on paper. There is a chance of 0.6% that we're wrong.
Well, I would argue that it's much bigger than 0.6% because there are other errors that, and that's what the problem with pure statistics is. It's often hard to take out.
Yes. So we're of course trying to feed in all the errors that we can understand and try to get it right. But we have error bars from spectral modeling propagated onto initial masses ages, propagated onto the whole thing. We've been putting in error bars because of our sample selection that is giving rise to these things, right? So We've been trying our best, and yes, there are more uncertainties that we just cannot get our hands on. And I'll come to two of them in a moment, because at the moment what we can say is the Sarpita mass function alone seems not to explain the number of stars that we've got. I have not said any word on what is doing the job for us at the moment. This is only the pure finding here. Okay?
I have much more confidence in stars than in people, by
the way. Oh, my stars don't lie. These people are the Princeton consortium on statistics and everything, and they analyzed all the polling data.
Yeah,
and
but
came up with these, you know, and the reality is there was a lot of correlation between, you know, there was a lot of systematic effects that weren't being accounted for.
Exactly. So the biases, I'll come to that. This is basically the next slide. So I think we can make the point that there are more massive stars in 32 than we would expect from a normal Sarpita IMF. I think that's what we've got, and the strong statistical significance. Whether you feel happy with that or not.
I think the argument that there is an excess of stars is a very strong case for that, but I don't think it's 99%. That's all I thought I would say.
Is this evidence that Putin hacked the IMF?
Look at how proud that is.
As far as I can tell... As far as I can tell, I could not find any hacker on my computer, but that might be just me, not there. So we have to ask the question, so what is causing this excess of stars, and why can we not explain it with a Sarpita model? That's sort of this thing that you would have expected in the galaxy, maybe. And we have to ask a question about biases. So is there a bias in our sample? I already put in an answer here, unlikely. And the reason why I would be saying that is the following. There's a census of 30 Dorados, of all the stars that people could find that you've got there. And in that paper, they've been comparing the selection of their sample to the VFDS stars, and you can make a histogram of V-band magnitude, and you can basically write down what is the completeness then of the VFDS compared to this more full census of 32. You basically see that our completeness limit, so this is massive star end, this is low mass stars, it's sort of basically where we fall off from our magnitude limit in VFDS, but otherwise this completeness is pretty much uniform. And if there's any bias in the high mass end, then actually in the VFTS sample, we are missing some of the massive stars. If there's any bias, then it's, at least from this data, it's going in the other direction.
Well, if you take that point, it seems to go the other way.
If I take what?
If you take that higher mass one.
Yeah, so if I take that one, right, I could...
No, I mean, if you remove that from the full plot.
Right, you remove
the full trend seems to go the other way.
Mm. Why would you say that? Just because you have one outlier here? I don't think so.
Well, I don't know. It's hard to read out of a simple plot. I think it's a tricky game.
Well, this is a paper. Play with the data if you like. You can see maybe how complete we are in the different bins. But I think this is pretty convincing. It was pretty convincing to us that in our sample and the sample selection of the VFTS, there is not anything that is striking you that there is a big bias. The conclusion we came up with here is that the sample selection in VFTS is pretty much homogeneous and it's not obviously biased.
If I understand the argument you're making, it assumes that the Milky Way IMF Sarpita value is a number that's exactly known to be 2.35, blah, blah, blah. But there is error on that, so this comparison isn't quite... It seems like not quite the right comparison. You want to know what is the statistical error and systematic error on the number of stars above, the fractional number of stars above 30 solar masses in the Milky Way versus in 30 Dorados. And
yes, that would be the ideal number that you want to compare, but I guess, do you have the Milky Way data?
That would be awesome. It's just not, I guess it's not at all, given what you said about, you know, from Dan Wise's work and others about the uncertainty in the IMF in general. It's not at all obvious how well we know the thing you're trying to compare to.
You can compare models with models, so you know, people who model the universe, they use...
Absolutely. No, I agree. But I think it's an interesting question whether there's actually a difference, right? Sure. A metallicity dependence or something.
Absolutely true. And maybe we get at some point to have maybe the whole Carina Nebula do a similar analysis, and then we can really compare observations to observations, if you like.
Fabian, how many stars did you have to set aside because they were obviously lens?
How many?
Yeah.
So in total, it is so we have a sample of roughly 900 objects, uh-huh. and our final sample is roughly half of that. But it is binary, that is visual composites. Some of these stars are just sitting behind nebulosity, so the spectrum is totally noisy and you can't get any data for them. What else did we throw out? And there are a couple of objects that we cannot get into agreement with the stellar models. So I can't do anything with that.
Is the number you had to set aside consistent with the notion that many massive stars are binaries?
Yes. Yeah, you might want to have a look into Hyksana's 2013 paper. That is where the binary fraction or the multiplicity property of that same sample is discussed.
Okay.
But my problem with Rob is that they removed all the binaries which are all those binaries, and yeah. they analyzed the binaries which ones like they are now merged binaries. And there is nothing about the single stars, separate. So for me, it's really hard to. I'm still waiting for him to come to binaries.
That's nice. Keep calm.
Before we go on to that, I just want to ask one question. For me, the most interesting thing is to ask, is there an upper mass limit to stars?
Give me
I'm going to come to that. Okay. It's not just whether that's a parallel, but is there a cutoff?
Yep.
That's an important point, because there's some controversy about that. People have now claimed that the 300 solar mass stars in the Betelgeuse are not really that massive.
Is this the continuation of the R136 story?
Yeah.
They're consistent with being 150 or 200.
What did it start out as? A few thousand solar masses?
So where was it on the HR diagram, or is it one of the ones that's thrown out?
No, that's in the R136.
So that star is not in our sample. So we are free of. So most of our objects are basically isolated, and we are pretty much free of these crowding issues and that people sort of continue to discuss in our exhibits. That's not part of our. But I would really like to get now to the binaries, because that's obviously something that I've been working on for for some time in the past. We're running a bit out of time, so maybe I can hopefully accelerate it.
No.
All right. So what's going to happen to a mass function if you have binaries in there? I guess what you've been saying, you merge two stars, well, what you get out is a star that has a factor of two more mass.
Not necessarily, but
that's sort of the bit that you can get. So let's think about a mass function. Coeval stellar population. This is our mass function. It is truncated somewhere at a turn of mass. What are binaries going to do?
Loose fragments,
there you go, exactly. But of course, we are not going to populate the full mass function in here. There's only a fraction of the stars that will do the job. And so what we're going to get is sort of some extension beyond the turnoff. This extension is going to be by a factor of 2. That's the most that you can do with a binary. Merge two objects, you get a factor of 2 more in mass. And sort of...
Will you label your axis?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is the mass, log mass, and this would be... This is my... Early notation.
So the slope will be the same if you have flat mass ratio distribution. Is that what you want to say?
The slope in this bit that is, well, not really that well determined, I would say. I mean, so if you look into my population synthesis models, for example, where we've been exactly playing this game, you have some features in here.
But that excess doesn't start only at the turnoff either. There's some lower than the turnoff.
Yes, that's correct. So in principle, the whole thing does the following. But then at the same time, you're removing some stars in here, yeah, because you're moving them to higher masses. So there are more details going on. But I'm trying to give you the zeroth order impression of what is going to happen, because that's something that we can put into our IMF model to see what it does to our inference of the IMF slope.
Even if you sort of put in an adjusted IMF to account for mergers, you're assuming that if I merge two 30 solar mass stars and get a 60 solar mass star, that 60 solar mass merger product can be analyzed using a 60 solar mass single star that has not gone through a merger.
Let me get to that in a second step.
Okay.
One after the other. So what we can do is really simple, right? I've been trying to leave that on here. Because we choose usually an IMF model, and then we go through the whole process and trying to figure out what is the best IMF model that we have to choose to get that happening. And so what we've been doing is we've been parametrizing exactly sort of this extension, this tail to a mass function that is extending by a factor of 2. And we've been playing with some factor in here that describes how well populated this binary tail is going to be. Okay? If you plug in this as your IMF model, and you don't do anything else to the objects, to the stars, you'll find that your... where is it? I know it. So you find that you change your best fit IMF slope by roughly 0.1. And the way it goes is that it makes the inferred IMF slope steeper. So we're going from 1.9 to 2.0. That's if we include this accretion process, parameterized in this way. And it's easy to understand, because now you have a second way of forming very massive stars, namely just by merging the objects. So it's taking away a bit of the pressure on the IMF to populate this large, this high mass end. That's sort of the logic that is going behind. And now I'm coming back to the point that has been already made beforehand. This star is not going to be exactly the same star that we had before, this merged object. And the key ingredient in here is, for example, the age. It will experience rejuvenation. And we've been deriving the IMF, or we are only able to derive the IMF by taking the age distribution of stars and the initial mass distribution. So this merging is not only going to do something to our mass function, but it's also going to do something to our age distribution. And you have to feed that back into the inference process as well. And here's one way of doing that, or that's how we did it. So I'm trying to draw now the... the age distribution that I've been showing you earlier. Okay. And let's, for example, consider stars in this age range. Well, Selma, for example, has told us that in our sample, we can expect maybe that 30% of the stars are binary products. So 30% of the stars that we find in basically probably any of these age ranges, they will be rejuvenated. And that's exactly what we've been doing. We've been taking 30%, well, it's roughly 30%, I guess. Same here. Same here. And we know that the age that we've been inferring from single star models is too young. The real age of this object has to be older.
30% in the total sample, or only in the sample of those which you think are single stars?
This is 30% in our sample, but...
which is a total sample, 1,000 stars. So
Selma's Selma's 30% is from a stellar population of O stars that has experienced the continuous star formation in the past. That's where this 30% comes from. It is not a 30% that we have been computing exactly for our sample selection and for our star formation history and so on and so forth. It is an order of magnitude estimate of how many binary products we expect in such a sample. Go and play with 40%.
In the sample of those which you think are single stars, or in the sample of those which are total?
30% refers to the total.
Okay, so it's 300 out of 450.
No, 300 will be unaffected by rejuvenation. 150 will be sort of these binary products, and 300 of our stars will be...
So Nikash is saying that you have 30% out of the 1,000, and those 30% will appear single, and you're selecting for the single one. So that's a...
Oh, so you want to... Yes, you want to get that... Yeah. So you can make your sample selection, or you can try to get it to the VFS sample selection of apparent single stars, and Selma has done the same job, and then this number of 30%, I think, goes up to 40%. Selection of apparent single stars in 30 is a bit more complicated than just saying you only have all the...
But this 30% refers to merging during the main sequence, or...?
It refers to merging, refers to mass transfer.
During, mass,
during the main sequence.
During the main sequence. Okay.
All right. So if the star is extremely young, well, it will rejuvenate by some amount. We've been parameterizing this some amount, and we've been, I think, using, I wrote it down, that the star after mass transfer appears 30% younger than it really is. That's sort of an average number if you do some main sequence merging. And if you then correct for this 30%, well, you have to take this one-third, or how many binary products you think there are in your age distribution, and you have to basically distribute them. Let me try to be more accurate. Put them down here. They're younger by 30%, so they go down there. These objects, well, they have an absolute age that's a bit bigger, a bit older, so they would maybe move down here. And these objects then maybe move somewhere over here.
You can. I don't understand that, because the 30% wouldn't be distributed evenly across there. If you're looking at the bin of things that are 1 million years, they're very likely to be merger products or mass gainers, because they're the blue stragglers.
But right? Don't forget that, of course, the whole region we're looking into has some star formation history. So maybe even in this time, there are still stars forming. So I would totally be with you in saying that the chances that the youngest objects are also, on average, most of the blue stragglers, I would agree with you. But there are also some stars that are probably not.
I'm not saying it's 100%, but it's higher than 30 in that youngest.
Fine. I would be happy with that. Because the way this bias is going to go, in the end, it makes the inferred IMF slope flatter. It deviates even more from Sapita. And if I'm increasing any of these numbers, put it to 40%, 50%, whatever, make the rejuvenation more, it is only going in the direction the IMF
exactly.
Must be
so
even flatter.
The original IMF should be thicker.
No, flatter in this
case. No, effects make it flatter.
No. Wait, hang on. Mass accretion makes it the inference of the IMF. It helps to form massive stars. So you need only you can have a steeper mass function to explain the number of massive stars. Rejuvenation goes the opposite. Wait a second. I'll tell you why.
Fabian, this idea of rejuvenation is still assuming that when two stars merge, you get something that is identical to a single star evolution with a different mass and a different age, but it will evolve then as a single star with its clock turned back. How correct is that?
Well, that probably depends for a merger, for example, on when you merge two stars. Is it early on in the evolution, probably the structure can adjust to its new mass and you're going to be fine. If you do it towards the terminal H-main sequence, then probably not. And then the star can really take a different track in the Hirschman-Russell diagram. Mm-hmm. Absolutely correct. So that is not really in this simple approach, but I guess the zeroth order is going to be that you miss or you basically screw up your ages.
Okay.
That's something that we can handle, or you can try to see what is happening if you include that. All right, so now it's going to be the really most difficult bit to understand why rejuvenation is going to lead to a flatter IMF. The point, or the thing that you need to realize is that the most massive stars are also the youngest. Just a lifetime effect. Okay. And if you then, for example, only look at a group of young objects in here, their average mass is going to be higher than later on in the evolution. There's a correlation between the average age of stars and the average age, average mass and the average age. Yeah, and this correlation, if you're removing young objects, you're removing on average massive stars. And if you're removing massive stars, again, you have a need for the IMF to be more top-heavy to explain the observations of the number of stars. This is a correlation between mass and age. And in that regard, mass accretion and rejuvenation, they work in both in opposite directions. This is going to steepen the inferred IMF slope. This is going to flatten it. And we've been playing basically independently with these two numbers, and just with this 30% from Selma and this rough amount of rejuvenation that we've got from some of our main sequence merging. These two effects were basically canceling out each other. So this was of the order of 0.1 steepening the mass function, and this thing was of the same order of magnitude. So these two effects are going to cancel out, or help to cancel out.
I actually think I do understand why rejuvenation works the way it does, but not from your explanation, because your explanation makes it go the same way, right? What you're saying is that if you have merger products, you artificially get more massive stars, right? So some of your more massive stars aren't actually coming from the IMF, they're coming from merger products. If you have rejuvenation, you artificially get younger-looking stars, and younger-looking stars tend to be more massive, so it's equivalent saying you artificially get more massive-like stars. So actually, things go the same way in your explanation.
No, be careful. what is now the fake mass and what is the real mass, or mass in the fake age and the real age that you're looking into here. Rejuvenation, the distribution that we see is, on, we have a distribution that is biased towards young ages. Okay? If you're biased to young ages, as you said, there is a, on average, the mass of stars is going to be higher. The real age distribution will be older on average. Yeah? So what you're doing, if you correct for the ages, you have on average an older distribution, so you make your stellar sample also on average less massive. But then you have the total number of stars that you have been observing in this mass range, and to again come up with this deficit of massive stars that you've just been producing by changing the ages, you have to make the mass function slope steep as a flatter.
Okay, so can you just run through this? So here we have 30 plus 30 stars. One goes through mass transfer, one goes accretion, one goes through merger. How does it change your ages? I think I'm just completely missing something.
Just think of a merger of, say, 30 and 30.
Yeah.
What is the lifetime of a 30 solar mass star? It's going to be, I don't know,
5 million, 8-ish,
7 million years? Okay. What's the lifetime of a 60 solar mass star?
Not much smaller.
3, 4. So there's a difference just in the lifetime of the stars by 2 million years, for example, in this case. So if you see a 30 solar mass star at the terminal age main sequence, you would say, okay, the star has an age of, what did you say, 7 million years. If you take two 30 solar mass stars at the terminal age main sequence, you merge them to produce one 60 solar mass star, the star again will basically sit at the terminal age main sequence, and you would say, okay, the 60 solar mass star has an age of 4 million years because that is its main sequence lifetime. So you have been making this star younger by, say, 2 million years. Only from your experience, only because...
Natasha's asking, if you take a 30 solar mass star and you accrete it and turn it into a 60, merge and you turn it into a 60, what's different?
Well, probably nothing.
It depends on when you do it.
It's going to be basically the same effect. I mean, both view merging and mass accretion...
That goes different.
Yeah.
No, in terms of ages, it goes the same way. In both cases, you rejuvenate the accretor.
Yeah, but then why it affects the slope differently?
It doesn't.
It didn't say.
I don't think
he said that one goes plus one, one goes minus 0.1, and then it comes in, they do opposite effect. But this is what he said.
No. What I'm saying is only the mass accretion gives you a channel to produce, for example, a 60 solar mass star that you don't need to get from birth.
I also
using massive stars in by accretion, but by rejuvenation. It's all about the inference of the INS slope.
So I think the question Natasha's saying, I also heard that these two effects have different net effects on the inferred IMF. And I think she's asking, if you blur your eyes, accretion and merger do the same thing. How do they have different net effects?
I think there's a misunderstanding.
Okay.
That's not accretion and merger.
No. This is only
if you modify different.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If you only modify the mass. So in this case, we are accreting the emerging stars, but we are not rejuvenating them.
Right.
And if you only do that, then the inferred IMF slope is going to be steeper by 0.1. Now, if you do not accrete the mass, but you only consider that stars will have been rejuvenated, forget about mass accretion, but we know that some of them will be rejuvenated, then the inferred IMF slope will be flatter by 0.1. If you combine the two now, I'm sorry?
Put a minus sign there.
Depending on how you want to define it.
Okay.
Stephen, well, it depends from where you're looking into. Yeah. If you combine two effects, which nature, what has happened in our sample, these two effects will cancel each other. That's what I try to say. It's difficult to get one set across.
Can you not much easier explain it by just saying that you're adding stars at the top of the main sequence because of all this stuff? You have stars there, but you have these 18 which you access that you have, and then you get just a less steep slope.
Yes, well, that's what I tried to say.
No, so you're saying that it's canceled by this other effect.
It's a less steep slope now.
So with this mass accretion, I'm adding massive stars that have not been there by birth. But at the same time, I'm rejuvenating them. So I screw up the age distribution. And both the mass distribution that I see and the age distribution, they're entangled. So I have to disentangle to get back to the IMF. And both of these will affect the inference of the IMF slope. And individually, accretion and rejuvenation go in opposite directions. That's what I try to.
So if you take a pretty solar mass star, and whatever it's called, what is 4 mass?
A 30 solar mass star.
Yeah.
It is 4 mass, 70.
Or 60 solar mass star. Is it exactly 2?
No, it's going to be larger.
So
there's yet another thing that you're alluding to. The thing that I was telling you was sort of the apparent rejuvenation. That's what just the difference in the lifetimes of stars. But at the same time, there's going to be mixing into the core. So you're going to reverse the internal clock of a star. And this is even making it even younger. I was only telling you half of the story. I'll show you. I have a nice figure for that later. I can show you what I mean.
There's one thing maybe to say that it's nice to try to understand all this and infer on the really initial mass distribution of all stars, first distribution. If you are just interested in the feedback of massive stars, all this doesn't matter. You don't need to worry whether your 60 solar mass star was born as 230 solar mass stars or as 160. So for the feedback story, the binary effect is completely uninteresting. So, you know how many supernovae you get, things like that.
Unless the mergers remove supernovae because it makes the star so massive that it will collapse or black hole or something.
Comes out of the observed distribution, you know, without encountering the binary effect.
All right. We can discuss it. I was at least promising to get to the upper mass limit, and I guess we have to maybe discuss feedback a bit later. This is a kind of view graph that I would like to put up for the inference now of the stellar upper mass limit. So we have a sample, and in our sample, the most massive star has a mass of roughly 200 solar masses, plus minus, I think the inferred error bar was 50. This is one sigma error bar. So if you want to, maybe we want to make now a statement about upper mass limits we can really exclude from our observations. So let's say the upper mass limit was 1,000 solar masses. Or in this diagram, it's probably better, let's say it was 500 solar masses. Okay? So this was our upper mass limit. And now I'm sampling stellar population, as we have observed in VFTS, that has the same total stellar mass. I'm using an upper mass limit of 500, and then I'm looking into the probability that there will be one star above a certain initial mass. We are in a low number statistics regime, so we have to do basically stochastic sampling. Okay, and I can repeat this experiment many times, and then I can come up with the probability function here for a 500 solar mass limit. So for example, if we give birth to the same stellar population that we have in 30 door in terms of total mass, with this upper mass limit and with our inferred IMF slope, then there is a chance of, roughly 40% that there will be one star in our sample that should be above 400 solar masses initially. From our sample that we have, the most massive beast is 200 plus minus 50, we don't have such an object. So at that point, we can ask ourselves, so what kind of confidence level do we need to believe that we can exclude an upper mass limit? So I put standard kind of 90% confidence level in here. So you see, in this 90% confidence level for a 500 solar mass star, you would expect that there is, with 90% probability, at least one star above 250 solar masses. And I think that can just be excluded from the data that we have. So we know that if star formation worked in this stochastic sense, then the upper mass limit can probably not be more than 500 solar masses. It might be within the statistic just at the edge, depending on what you want to have for confidence level. And I leave that up to you. You can put your confidence level that you want and take the mass measurements that we have, and then you can decide which upper mass limit you want to exclude or not. I was excluding basically anything above 500 from this. And then if you go down with the upper mass limit, basically, a 400 solar mass upper mass limit, for example, it has a probability of 85% maybe that there's one star above 250 solar masses. But then again, you're getting into exactly this issue. What is your confidence level that you trust in that you say, okay, this can be excluded. And we've been conservative here and saying, okay, we can exclude anything above 500 solar masses, but below 500 that is possible, at least from the data that we've got. And be reminded, this is the stellar region or the stellar population that has best statistics in terms of massive stars. I think if you really want to do it honestly, this is as good as it can get. That's all probably we can say from this stellar population.
The crucial hypothesis here is that you do a stochastic sampling.
Yes. It makes an assumption in how star formation works. If star formation works differently, all this experiment is basically a nonsense. Yes. Yeah. It makes the assumption basically if you have a cloud of 500 solar masses that it can form only one star. That's something that we include in this hypothesis.
But also if the most massive stars you observe are actually merger products.
So the thing that we can do from this experiment is we can only exclude anything above 500 solar masses. And now we have exactly to ask the question, if this 200 solar mass object that we have in our sample was a merger product, what kind of upper mass limits do we need while taking binary interactions into account to produce that star? That's an experiment we have not been doing, because that is complicated for 30DOI. You basically need to do a full population synthesis model for stars in this mass range where basically none exist in the literature. So that's basically where we stopped in this experiment. We've been doing a similar experiment with the Arches star cluster, because it is a simple stellar population. It's coeval, and then you can play that game more easily. And I think... we did it with R136, not with Arches. With R136, and in that cluster at that time, I think we said that if you take binary mass transfer into account, and if you believe in this 300 solar mass star that has been observed, you need at least an upper mass limit of something like 200 solar masses to make it. Because otherwise it's just getting unlikely to even form such a massive beast. But there, in these computations, we did neglect any dynamical cluster dynamics that also can produce massive objects. But they probably do not contribute too much at that point. That's
When you say you put a cutoff, is this just a sharp cutoff, exponential cutoff?
A sharp cutoff.
And after the cutoff, you're assuming that you have your best fit gamma of minus 1.9.
Yes, that's exactly. That's
full. Below the cutoff.
Is there a below cutoff?
Yeah,
of course. So basically, you can say already pretty good confidence that there has to be a cutoff.
If you believe in this star formation mode, yes. I would say there needs to be a cutoff.
Okay. You would see even more massive stars than what you have.
Exactly.
And now the question is whether the most massive stars you're seeing might be post-merger projects. But the other possibility is they could be unresolved binaries.
Yes.
Right? And those are both distinct issues.
Exactly.
And if that happens, then the upper mass that you see is actually now lower. And then the cutoff would be much lower than this.
Yes, so there are two limits that you want to constrain. You want to exclude upper mass limits. That's what we can do with the data at hand. But we cannot say, for example, what is the most likely upper mass limit, the smallest upper mass limit that we need to explain these massive stars, either by some unresolved binaries or by binary merging, binary products, and whatsoever. That's something we cannot say anything about at the moment. So we can basically only exclude the upper limit, but
there is a cutoff.
There is a cutoff if you believe in this mode of stuff.
There's enough stars to conclude there is a cutoff.
Yes.
If you can just slope at minus 1.9, there is a cutoff.
Well, you can play this game with different slopes, right? I mean, this is not... But it will only make it sort of, if you go back to Salpeter, I mean, you're having more problems. So you can probably put this cutoff then even to lower masses, yes. Okay. All right.
No, because with Salpeter, then it's steeper. Oh, yeah, that's right. Then you have to.
Yeah.
Then, in fact, then that means that you would not expect to see you expect to see fewer massive stars. So that would push you to a point where it'd be hard to pull off.
Sure, or alternatively, you could say that you have minus 1.9 going up to 200 solar masses, and then it becomes minus 2.9 above 200 solar masses.
If we were to stop at Salpeter, then the statistics are consistent with just not having enough stars.
Yes, you have more of a stochastic sampling problem than you.
So the cutoff would be larger.
Just one question I have is, this happens at the top of the main sequence that you get this different slope. But what happens lower when you rejuvenate? You have this rejuvenation effect all over the all along the main sequence, of course. And so I did not see this flattening at lower masses. So what happens?
I think it's exactly the same story, if you like. So if you're at an older age in this age distribution, these are sort of lower mass main sequence stars, and we would again make them really older. And so again, in this mass range, you would move the average mass that we have observed to lower mass, and we again need a slightly flatter IMF to compensate for that.
But then all along the main sequence, this whole flattening must be happening.
Yes. Yes.
I did such type of calculations very long ago. In 69, I had a little paper on this rejuvenation effect from binaries on the distribution of masses. And I found something like 30% of the stars should be binary, rejuvenated binaries. But I had no idea that it would change the slope of the IMF actually.
Yeah, that's something that I only realized after hard thinking. It took me some time to figure that out. Yeah. There's one other bias, but maybe there's a bias with runaways. We have not observed R136, and there can be runaways coming from that cluster and polluting our sample. And runaways will be, on average, more massive there. And then more, in relative terms, there are more O-star runaways and B-star runaways. So it's going to bias our sample, but you can play out the numbers and actually...
It's still true if you only consider the O-stars, because here you're taking only the O-stars. So among the O-stars, is there still a bias for more massive runaways?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is. You have to fiddle that in. The numbers work out in such a sense that the excess stars that we have are way too many to explain them by runaways from R136. That is basically the only region that we have not observed with VFTS. That's a short answer to runaways. If you want to hear more about that, please ask me. But I really would like to put up this last slide on the feedback, and then I'll let you go. So if you have this top-heavy IMF, that's in the beginning when I was basically explaining that, for example, if you go below 2.0, then all your number of massive stars and so on, they will depend on the upper mass cutoff that you chose. So this is the IMF slope here, and then the number of massive stars, and this is now comparing a top-heavy IMF with whatever slope you want to have here to a Salpeter model. So Salpeter model is basically here, so that's where you have again a ratio of 1, and this is then the increase in the number of massive stars that you get, and massive stars, I think I called here anything that is above 10 solar masses. And then you see, depending on the upper mass limit that you chose, this is sort of the range that we inferred from 32. It is possible. You see that then the number of these massive stars change differently for different IMF slopes. Just to keep that in mind, it makes a quite big difference in here. You can then compute the number of black holes and see how much they are affected by different IMF slopes if it's top heavy. You can play the same game with integrated wind energy. You can play the game with supernova metal yields, and where we actually have been putting in pair-instability supernovae. And it's an easy exercise to do because you have basically to integrate the IMF. Put in whatever function you want there and integrate it and then compare.
The relative increases in percent is factor.
The factor, yes. And I should say I've been always giving birth to stellar population of the same mass. So I'm normalizing the population that was born with a top-heavy IMF to one solar mass and compare that to one born with a Salpeter mass function also to one solar mass. So in both cases, we've been producing the same total amount of mass. Anyhow, these factors can be quite large. You can play that game and also this is the same thing as before, just to give you the legend. And you can play the same game, for example, for ionizing radiation, for hydrogen ionizing radiation, helium ionizing radiation, and if you think of, you go back into the early universe, for example, where maybe the mass function slope is even flatter. Think about the Metallicity effect, and for the first stars, people have been claiming that there are many more massive stars, and you will get really an incredibly huge increase in the action of ionizing photons, for example. Can go up by an order of magnitude if you play the game.
IMFs of, no one believes an IMF of 1.
Well, don't say that. I mean, in some of these population-free star formation simulations, I think they found even a uniform that would correspond to 0 in these units.
So population-free, okay.
Yeah. So this is the limit. If you, well, so we are maybe here in sort of Sarpita land, but then you go to...
Reionization of the early universe might be important.
Yeah. I'm just saying, if you want to make your case for all your proposals, this stuff that I did say before, the top IMF is certainly going to be your friend. But I'll stop here. Thanks.